I never thought in my life Phoenix would turn into this twisted mess. But looking back, it all started with the heat. The relentless Arizona sun that baked everything into submission. My name's Julia, and I ran this little hole-in-the-wall restaurant called La Fiesta on the edge of downtown. It was nothing fancy. Red checkered tablecloths, sizzling fajitas, and margaritas strong enough to make you forget the bills piling up. I poured my soul into that place after Carlos and I got married 10 years ago. He was charming back then, with that sly smile and promises of a better life. But marriage changes people. Or maybe it just reveals who they really are. Carlos wasn't the type to hold down a steady job. He dabbled in side hustles, as he called them. At first it was harmless, flipping used cars or hawking gadgets at flea markets. But somewhere along the line, it turned darker. He'd source these knockoff luxury bags and watches from shady suppliers in LA, then slap on fake labels and sell them as authentic deals to our neighbors. Pop-up markets and parking lots, Craigslist listings, even Facebook Marketplace under his brother Miguel's name to keep the heat off him. Miguel lived in Mexico and didn't give a damn. Carlos paid him a cut to stay quiet. People would bite. Desperate housewives wanting a real Louis Vuitton for half price. Guys impressing dates with Rolex watches that ticked like bombs. When the fakes fell apart, buyers were left holding worthless crap, too embarrassed to complain or with no way to track them down. Carlos was smart like that. He never got caught.
"It's just business, mi amor,"
he'd say, kissing my neck while counting stacks of cash in our kitchen. I turned a blind eye because, hell, it kept the lights on at La Fiesta. Then there was Kevin. God, Kevin. He started coming in about 2 years ago, always alone, nursing a beer at the bar while stealing glances at me. He was in his late 30s, divorced. Worked as some IT guy for a local firm. He wasn't bad looking, tall, with that boyish grin, but way too earnest for his own good. He'd chat me up about the menu, the weather, anything to linger.
"Julia, these enchiladas are killer. You must have a secret ingredient,"
he'd say, his eyes lingering a beat too long. I knew he was smitten. Men like him wear it like a neon sign. I'd flirt back a little. Harmless, right? It boosted tips, and honestly, it felt good to be desired after Carlos's wandering eyes. One slow Tuesday night, Kevin leaned in closer than usual.
"Hey, Julia, you ever hear about those scam artists selling fake designer stuff around here? I read some complaints on Ripoff Report next door. It sounded shady."
I froze mid-pour of his refill.
Not really. Why do you ask?"
He shrugged, but his face lit up like he'd found buried treasure.
"Just educating myself. Thinking of hosting a community meetup at the library. Teach folks how to spot counterfeits. You know, check serial numbers, feel the leather. Could save people a ton of money."
My stomach twisted. Carlos had just unloaded a batch of Gucci bags the week before. I smiled tightly and changed the subject. But inside, alarm bells rang. That night, I told Carlos everything. He laughed it off at first, calling Kevin a lonely loser with a crush. But when Kevin's meetup started, flyers plastered around the neighborhood, posts on local Facebook groups, Carlos's sales dipped. People were wising up, whispering about that woman at La Fiesta's husband. No one connected it directly to us, but the paranoia set in.
"Julia, this cabrón is killing my business,"
Carlos growled one evening, slamming his phone down after another canceled order. We were in the back of the restaurant, the smell of grease hanging heavy.
"He's got the hots for you, that's why. Thinks if he plays hero, you'll spread your legs for him."
I rolled my eyes.
"What do you want me to do, ban him?"
Carlos's eyes darkened, that possessive fire igniting.
"No, we turn it around. You cry harassment and say he's been grabbing you, whispering dirty shit. I'll catch him in the act. Problem solved."
It sounded insane, but desperation makes you stupid. Our restaurant was barely breaking even, and Carlos's scams were our lifeline. Plus, Kevin's puppy dog eyes had started creeping me out. So I nodded.
"Fine, but nothing too crazy."
The next time Kevin came in, I played it up. He ordered his usual tacos al pastor and tried his flirty routine. "Julia, you're looking gorgeous tonight. That dress hugs you just right." I forced a blush, then leaned in like I was confiding. "Kevin, you've got to stop. This attention, it makes me uncomfortable." His face crumpled. "What? I didn't mean..." Before he could finish, I raised my voice.
"You've been harassing me, touching me when I serve, saying things about my body. I want you out!"
Customers turned, murmuring. Kevin stammered.
"Julia, that's not... I just like you, okay? I thought... Get out before I call the cops!"
He bolted, red-faced, but not before muttering. "This is bullshit." "Perfect." I texted Carlos. "Now." That night, after closing, I knew Kevin would circle back. He always walked home past the alley. And sure enough, around midnight, I heard footsteps. I stepped out the back door, pretending to take out trash. And there he was, looking wrecked.
"Julia, please, I need to explain. Those scams, your husband." "Kevin, stop!"
I shouted, backing away like he was advancing. He wasn't, but perception is everything. Carlos exploded from the shadows, a hurricane of rage.
"You touching my wife, pinche gringo?"
He grabbed Kevin by the collar, slamming him against the dumpster. Kevin gasped, flailing.
"What the... Carlos, I know about your fakes. You're the one scamming. Shut your mouth!"
Carlos roared, his fist connecting with Kevin's jaw. Kevin hit the ground hard. I watched, heart pounding as Carlos snatched a cleaning hose from the wall. The one we used for mopping, still dripping with bleaching chemicals. He wrapped it around Kevin's neck, yanking tight.
"You think you can ruin me, cabrón? I'll end you right here!"
The acrid smell of chemicals burned my nose as he gurgled, face turning purple.
"Please, Julia, help me!"
I froze. This wasn't the plan. We were just supposed to scare him, rough him up. But Carlos was lost in his fury, veins popping, grunting like an animal.
"Oh, you piece of shit! No one fucks with my family!"
Kevin's legs kicked wildly, urine soaking his pants in terror. I snapped out of it.
"Carlos, stop! You're gonna kill him!"
He hesitated, just long enough for Kevin to twist free, gasping, retching on the pavement. He scrambled up, hose marks raw on his neck, and bolted into the night, screaming hoarsely.
"You're both crazy! I'll tell everyone!"
But he didn't. Maybe fear silenced him. Or shame. We waited for cops, but none came. Kevin vanished, quit his job. Moved out of state, from what I heard through the grapevine. Whispers died down. People forgot all about his meetups. Life went on. Carlos ramped up his scams. Bolder now, using new aliases. I kept slinging plates at La Fiesta, smiling through the exhaustion. Part of me regretted it. The violence. The lies. But in this world, you protect your own. Us women in Phoenix, we learned that early. Survive the heat. The hustles, the men who drag you down or lift you up. Carlos and I, we're survivors. And as I locked up the restaurant that final night, counting another stack of dirty money, I knew we'd keep going. No fairy tales here, just real life. Raw, unrelenting. I just moved to Denver from the East Coast, chasing a job in tech that promised fresh air and better work-life balance. Colorado was supposed to be all about mountains, craft beer, and laid-back vibes. But after a few weeks, I was feeling isolated. I didn't have any friends yet. Just my apartment overlooking the Rockies and endless Zoom calls. So, like any guy in his late 20s, I downloaded a dating app. I swiped right on a few profiles, nothing serious. Then there was Emily. Her pic showed this cute brunette with freckles, smiling in front of snowy peaks or sipping coffee at some indie spot in Lodo. We matched and chatted for a couple days. Light stuff, like favorite breweries and how she'd grown up in Boulder. She seemed normal, fun even. "You've gotta let me show you around. There's this killer spot up in the foothills. Dinner first?" she messaged one evening. I figured why not. It'd beat another night scrolling Netflix alone. We met at a farm-to-table place downtown. She showed up in jeans and a flannel shirt, hair tied back, looking effortlessly Colorado. "Hey, stranger, I hope you're hungry. Their bison burgers are insane," she said with a grin. She hugged me like we'd known each other forever. Dinner was easy. We talked about my move, how the altitude was kicking my ass, making me short of breath on simple walks. She laughed, a genuine belly laugh. "That's everyone's first month here. Drink more water, city boy." She shared stories about her ex, some guy who ghosted her after a year, and how she was over dating apps but gave it one more shot. "People are weird, you know, but you seem normal." I chuckled, flattered. "Yeah, well, I try." After paying the bill, she insisted on splitting it. We headed to her car, an old Subaru with stickers from national parks plastered on the back. "Trust me," she said, starting the engine. "The drive up to Lookout Mountain is worth it. Stars like you've never seen." I was new to the area, so I went with it. The city lights faded as we climbed, winding roads flanked by dark pines. She cranked up some indie folk playlist, humming along. "You ever think about how small we are out here? Like, one wrong turn and poof, no one finds you," she asked, glancing at me. I nodded, thinking it was just poetic mountain talk. "Yeah, nature's humbling." We parked at a pullout, no other cars around. The air was crisp, moon full and bright. "Come on, there's a trail that leads to this bench. Best view in the state," she said, grabbing my hand. We walked in silence at first, our footsteps crunching on gravel. The path opened to a clearing, and sure enough, there was this weathered wooden bench overlooking a valley. No street lights, just moonlight casting everything in silver. We sat, shoulders touching. It felt romantic, like something out of a rom-com. "This is amazing. Thanks for bringing me here," I whispered. She leaned back, staring at the sky. "You know what I like about places like this? The isolation. No one around to hear you scream." I turned, expecting a joke. But her face was serious for a beat before she smiled. "Kidding. Sort of." We talked more, about work, dreams. Then she shifted topics. "You ever listen to true crime stuff, like serial killers?" I shrugged. "A little bit. Podcasts on run sometimes." Her eyes lit up. "Oh man, I'm obsessed. Ted Bundy, right? He was from around here-ish. Charmed his way into women's lives, then bam!" She snapped her fingers. "What do you think makes someone snap like that?" I paused for a minute, unsure. "I don't know. Trauma, wiring in the brain?" She nodded slowly. "Maybe. But sometimes I wonder. What if it's just curiosity? Like, could I get away with it?" She tilted her head, watching me. "I used to think about getting away with stuff like that sometimes. You know, the perfect crime, no traces." My stomach tightened a little. "That's dark. You're joking, right?" She burst out laughing, this wild echoing cackle that bounced off the trees. It wasn't the same as her dinner laugh. It was unhinged, like something from a horror flick. "Oh, come on, lighten up. Everyone has those thoughts, don't you?" "Not really. I'm more of a live and let live guy," I admitted, forcing a smile. She grabbed my arm suddenly, her grip firm. "You're cute when you're nervous." The fabric was rough, but I could feel the warmth underneath. "Feel that? Smooth, right?" "Emily, I started, but she shushed me. "Shh, imagine this." Pale skin glowed in the moonlight. "I want you to carve your initials here with a knife. Like, mark me, forever." I froze. "What? You're kidding." Her eyes locked on mine, intense.
No, I'm dead serious. It'd be hot. Pain and pleasure, you know? Come on, you've got a pocket knife or something?
No. My heart pounded. This wasn't flirty. It was f***ed up. But she reached into her boot and pulled out a small switchblade, then flicked it open with a click.
Here, I'll help.
Emily, stop. This isn't funny. She pressed the blade to her skin, right above her knee. Watch. And she did it. Slow, deliberate. A thin line of red bloomed as she carved a jagged J for my name. Jason. Blood welled up, trickling down her leg. She winced but smiled through it, biting her lip.
Your turn. Add the A and S.
Bile rose in my throat. The metallic scent hit me, mixed with pine. I gagged, almost puking right there.
What the? You're insane!
I yanked my hand away, standing up. She laughed again, that maniacal sound.
Oh, baby, don't be scared. It's just, it's nothing. Come back.
I bolted, just ran down the trail, branches whipping my face. My phone flashlight bounced wildly as I sprinted to the road. No signal up there. I kept going downhill toward civilization. After what felt like miles, lights appeared, a gas station at the base. I burst in, panting. The clerk, an older guy, looked up from his magazine.
You okay, son?
No, I need to call the cops, or a cab, something. I gasped. He eyed me warily, but handed over his phone. I dialed 911 and explained as best as I could without sounding crazy.
My date, she's crazy. She cut herself, then asked me to do it. She's up in the mountains. Help, please.
The dispatcher was calm. Stay put. We'll send someone. Cops arrived 20 minutes later. I told them everything. The app, dinner, the drive, the knife. They drove me back up, but her car was gone. No sign of her.
Look into it. But if she's not pressing charges, one officer said.
Back home, I blocked her on the app and changed my number. I couldn't sleep for days, replaying it. The way her laugh echoed. The blood on her thigh. I googled her name later. Found nothing alarming. Just a LinkedIn profile. Maybe it was all a game to her. Some twisted thrill.
This story has been inspired from a real-life experience shared by one of our subscribers. This is what they said. I once went on a date with a girl who, after dinner, offered to show me around since I was new in town. She drove us up into the mountains, and eventually the road got darker and emptier. No houses, no streetlights, just us. Out of nowhere, she brought up serial killers, and casually mentioned how she sometimes wondered what it would be like to get away with something like that. That line has stuck with me ever since.
I never thought I'd end up back in my mom's house at 32. But life has a way of kicking you when you're down. It was right after I got laid off from the warehouse job in Phoenix. Some corporate manager bullshit that left half the crew scrambling. Rent was due, and my savings were a joke. Barely enough for a week's groceries. Mom lived alone in that old split level in Scottsdale. The one Dad built before he passed from cancer 10 years back. She was thrilled when I called her. Her voice all warm and quivery on the phone. Andrew, honey, come home. There's plenty of room, and I can use the company. I felt a rush of relief, like a kid again, safe under her roof. Grateful didn't even cover it. I hugged her tight when I pulled up with my beat-up truck, boxes piled up in the back. The first few weeks were okay, almost good. I helped with chores, mowed the lawn, fixed the leaky faucet in the kitchen, all while job hunting. My mom would make her famous lasagna, the kind with extra cheese that stuck to your ribs, and we'd watch reruns of those old sitcoms she loved. "Remember when you were little and we'd laugh at these?" she'd say, patting my knee. I'd nod, smiling, even though my mind was elsewhere, worrying about interviews that never planned out. But then weird stuff started. It began with the crying. I'd be in my old room upstairs, scrolling through job listings late at night, and I'd hear it. Soft, mumbled sobs coming from her bedroom downstairs. At first, I thought maybe she was upset about something, missing Dad or whatever. I knocked once around midnight. Mom, you okay in there? The crying abruptly stopped, and she opened the door, her face blank, hair tousled, like she'd just woken up. What are you talking about, Andrew? I'm fine. Go back to bed. No tears on her cheeks, nothing. I shrugged it off, but it happened again a few nights later, louder this time, like someone was heartbroken. I confronted her in the morning over coffee. I heard you crying last night. Mom, if something's wrong, you can tell me. She just stared at me, stirring her mug slowly. I wasn't crying, dear. Must have been the wind or a neighbor. Bullshit, I thought, but I let it go. A few days later, I had an interview lined up, a decent gig at a distribution center, and I pulled out my only nice shirt from the dryer. It was scorched, black marks across the collar, like someone had left the iron on it too long. Mom! What the hell? I yelled, storming into the living room, where she was folding the laundry. She looked up confused. I ironed that yesterday. It was fine. Fine? It's ruined. Did you do this on purpose? Her eyes widened. Why would I do that? Maybe the iron's acting up. I didn't buy it. The next week, my jeans came out with a single hole in the pocket. This is getting ridiculous, I muttered to myself. But aloud, I said, Mom, if you don't want me here, just say it. She shook her head, voice trembling. Andrew, I love having you here. Stop accusing me. The water shutoffs were the worst. I'd be in the shower, finally relaxing after a crappy day. Soap in my eyes, and then suddenly, nothing. The faucet would sputter and die. First time I figured it was a glitch, wrapped a towel around me and checked the basement valve. It was twisted off. Mom, I bellowed, dripping water on the carpet. She poked her head out of the kitchen. What now? Did you turn off the water? No, why would I do that? Maybe maintenance is working on the lines. But it happened 3 more times, always when I was mid-shower, freezing my ass off. One evening after a particularly bad one, I lost it. This is sabotage, isn't it? You're trying to make me miserable, so I'll leave. She backed away, hands up. Andrew, please, I swear, it's not me. Let's talk about this. I started believing she was gaslighting me, like those stories you hear about toxic parents who can't let go. My frustration built like a storm. Job search was going nowhere. Callbacks that led to, we'll let you know. And living with her felt like I was walking on eggshells. I'd lie awake, hearing those cries again, wondering if she was faking it to mess with my head. Why are you doing this? I asked over breakfast, and she replied softly. I'm not, honey. Maybe you're stressed from the job hunt. That pissed me off even more, that fake concern. One afternoon, I got off the phone with another rejection. Some HR lady saying I wasn't fit, and I went off to shower in defeat. Midway, the water was cut out again. I slammed the shower door, yanked on sweats, and charged downstairs. My mom was in the living room, ironing the cloth, the TV murmuring some soap opera in the background. You did it again, didn't you? I roared. She jumped, the iron clattering. Andrew, calm down. Liar. The valve is off, same as always. She set the iron down, voice steady but eyes scared. Maybe it's the city. Call them. No, it's you. You want me gone, I know it. I stepped closer, fist clenched. After everything, you're pulling this shit? She reached for me like to soothe. Honey, please, let's sit in. But I snapped. She snumbled back, crashing into the coffee table. She gasped, hand in her stomach, eyes wide with shock. I froze, rage draining away, replaced with horror. Mama, I'm sorry. but she was already grabbing the phone, dialing 911 with shaking fingers. "Please, my son just hit me." They arrived fast, two police officers cuffing me in the driveway while neighbors peeked from the windows. Mom stood there, ice pack on her stomach, tears streaming. "He didn't mean it," she whispered to them, but they hauled me away anyway. "Why'd you do it?" the detective asked, leaning across the table. I spilled it all, the cries, the burns, the water. "She was driving me crazy, trying to push me out," he nodded. Then another officer barged in. "Your mother's been diagnosed with early-stage Alzheimer's. Did you know that?" she asked. Alzheimer's. It hit like a truck. "No, I didn't know. She never said." The lady officer explained the crying was from a TV drama she watched obsessively, but forgot she turned it on. And some old show with dramatic scenes. The burnt clothes, when she'd start ironing and get distracted, and then leave the iron-on too long. And the water, routine maintenance from the neighborhood, notices that she had been mailed, and she probably misplaced them or forgot to mention. It wasn't sabotage, it was her mind slipping away. I sat in the cell, head in hands, guilt twisting my guts. How had I missed that? The forgetfulness, the confusion. My own mom, the woman who raised me alone after Dad died, bandaged my scraped knees, and I punched her. The charges stuck. Assault, domestic violence. Bail was set high, but a friend posted it. When I got out, Mom wouldn't see me. Her sister, Aunt Agatha, answered the door. "She's staying with me now, Andrew. Doctors say stress could worsen it. You need help, too." That was 6 months ago. I'm in anger management now, mandated by the court, and working a crap job at a fast food joint while the case drags on. Probation likely, but scars deeper. I drive by the old house sometimes and see a for sale sign. Mom's in assisted living, mild case, but it's progressing. I send cards apologizing in voicemails that she might not remember. "Mom, I was wrong. I love you. Please forgive me."
It was one of those humid summer evenings in Chicago. The kind where the air sticks to your skin and you can't decide if you're hungry or just bored. I'd matched with her on Bumble. Her name was Jamie, mid-30s, with a profile full of hiking pics and quotes about adventure. She seemed fun, edgy, the type who could keep up with my sarcasm. We chatted for a week, trading stories about bad exes and favorite dive bars. Finally, we decided to meet at this little Italian spot downtown. The one with the red checkered tablecloths and killer tiramisu. I got there first, nerves buzzing like they always do on first dates. I was wearing my go-to black dress, the one that hugs just right without trying too hard. And I sipped a glass of Pinot while scrolling through my phone. When Jamie walked in, she looked even better than her photos. Curvy, with short dark hair and a tattoo peeking out from her sleeve.
"Hi, you must be Sarah,"
she said, sliding into the booth across from me with a grin that lit up her face.
"Yeah, that's me. You found the place okay?"
I asked, smiling back.
"Totally. Traffic was a bitch, but worth it. You look great, by the way."
We ordered appetizers, bruschetta and calamari, and the conversation flowed easy at first. She told me about her job as a graphic designer, how she freelanced for bands and loved the chaos of it. I shared about my gig at the marketing firm, the endless meetings and coffee runs.
"God, I hate corporate sometimes. It's like, why am I wasting my 20s on spreadsheets?"
I said, rolling my eyes. Jamie laughed, a deep, genuine sound.
"Tell me about it. I quit my 9-to-5 last year. Best decision ever. Now I make my own rules. What about you? Any wild stories from your dating history?"
I hesitated, but dove in.
"Oh, plenty. There was this one guy, he showed up with his mom. I swear to God, she sat at the bar the whole time."
Jamie slapped the table, her eyes wide.
"No way. That's next level creepy. I'd have bolted." "Me? I dated a chick once who collected taxidermy animals. Like full-on stuffed squirrels in her living room.
We kept swapping stories, laughing over the wine. She had this dark humor that matched mine. Edgy jokes about true crime podcasts and what-if scenarios.
You ever think about how easy it is to disappear someone?
She asked at one point, dipping a fry into aioli. I chuckled.
Oh yeah, all the time. Blame Dateline for that.
By the time the check came, I was buzzed and optimistic. Maybe this could be something, I thought. She insisted on driving me home since my place was on her way, and I didn't argue. Ubers were pricey and it felt chivalrous in a way. We piled into her old Jeep, the seats worn and smelling faintly of cigarettes. The city lights blurred as she pulled onto the highway. That's when things shifted. At first it was subtle. You know, she said, glancing over with a smirk.
You're in my car now. I technically can take you wherever I want. You're like my prisoner.
I laughed because I thought it was just more of her dark humor.
Oh yeah? Planning a kidnapping? You better make it worth it. Stock up on snacks, please.
She grinned, but didn't drop it.
Seriously though, doors are locked. We're out here in the dark. I could veer off to some cabin in the woods and who'd know? Okay, Hannibal Lecter, chill out.
I teased, still smiling but feeling a tiny prick of unease. The radio was playing some old Taylor Swift song, ironic as hell. But she kept going.
Imagine it, you, tied up in the trunk, begging for mercy. I'd make you my little pet.
My laugh faltered this time.
Jamie, that's kinda intense. Come on, Sarah, you said you like dark stuff. Don't tell me you're scared.
Her voice had an edge now, like she was testing me. She reached over and squeezed my knee, lingering a second too long.
What if I don't take you home? What if we just drive forever? You belong to me now.
I shifted in my seat, staring out at the passing cars.
Yeah, funny. But seriously, my exit's coming up.
She ignored that.
Prisoners don't get exits. They get what I give them. Maybe I'll pull over, make you prove your loyalty. Stop the car. This isn't funny anymore.
I said, my voice sharper than I intended.
Oh, touchy, lighten up.
But she didn't stop talking, rambling about control and how women like me needed to be broken in. My heart was pounding, that gut instinct screaming red flags. I'd heard stories from friends, dates turning possessive, that subtle slide into danger. I kept asking myself why I hadn't driven myself. Finally, she pulled up to my apartment building.
There you go, prisoner. For now.
She winked, like it was all a joke. I forced a smile and unbuckled fast.
Thanks for the ride. Night.
As soon as the door shut, I bolted inside, locking everything behind me. My hand shook as I texted my best friend. Weird date. Call me. Little did Jamie know, that was the last time she'd ever see me. I blocked the number, deleted the app convo, even reported her profile. No replies to her missed calls the next day. Nothing. Looking back, it could have been worse. Way worse. The story has been inspired from a real-life experience faced by one of our subscribers. This is what they said. She was driving us back from dinner when she started joking. You know, now that you're in my car, I could just take you anywhere I want. You're basically my hostage. At first, I chuckled. Dark jokes don't usually throw me off. But when she kept doubling down on it, acting like it was still funny the third, fourth time around, something in me shifted. She had no idea that the moment I stepped out of that car would be the last time she ever saw me.
My boyfriend Tommy was obsessed with the TV series Black Mirror. It's this really dark Netflix series all about how technology can go wrong and ruin people's lives. The episodes never ended happily, so it wasn't really my thing. Tommy loved it, though. I'd hear him watching it in the other room almost every night. His twin brother Spencer was also a big fan. When the new season came out last month, the two of them binged the whole thing together. They spent all night watching that dark show. I couldn't handle watching a whole episode of Black Mirror. Watching an entire season in one sitting? That sounded like torture to me. Well, the day after their binge fest, Tommy tried to tell me all about his favorite episodes. I pretended to listen, but I really didn't. He got a little frustrated with me and said, "Just you wait. Some of those episodes will probably come true one day. With the way technology's advancing, it's only a matter of time." I just rolled my eyes and left the room. He was taking this fandom way too seriously. A few days later, I was on my computer when Tommy ran into my room with a panicked look on his face. "Rachel," he said, "don't do it." "Do what?" I had no idea what he was talking about. He said he knew that I was going to hurt him, and he wanted to reason with me before it was too late. I asked him what the hell he was talking about. He pulled out his phone and showed me a new app that he'd downloaded. It was some sort of AI thing that answered questions about what was going to happen in the future. You just type in your name and a specific time, and it'll tell you what you'll be doing. He showed me the results for that evening. It said I was going to get really angry at him and attack him with a knife. I was speechless. How could he possibly believe something like that? It was obviously some kind of stupid joke. He looked deadly serious, though. It was like he believed that he was living in some sort of Black Mirror episode. "I'm not going to stab you," I assured him. "Trust me." He backed away, acting scared. "I think I'm going to stay at my brother's tonight," he said. This whole thing was ridiculous, obviously. I was not in the mood to deal with Tommy's paranoia. I snatched the phone out of his hands to prove that the app was made up. "Look," I said. I refreshed the app, and then I typed in my name and today's date. And then I waited for a response. It took 5 seconds for the app to respond. "You will stab your boyfriend at 6:15 tonight." "See," he said, "it's the truth." Obviously, this app was just joking with us. It probably predicted murder for all its users. I changed the time to 30 minutes in the future and tried again. After 5 seconds, the app replied, "You will be called into work to handle an emergency." "Okay," I said. "Let's wait 30 minutes. If my work doesn't call me, then we'll know that this app is nonsense." I was confident that nothing was going to happen. Today was Saturday, and my work never needed me to be there in person on the weekend. They'd have to pay me overtime, which is something my boss would never do. 30 minutes later, my phone rang. Tommy's eyes widened in horror. "Are you going to answer it?" he asked. I looked down at my phone and saw that it was the office calling. I answered it, and I listened to my boss ask if I could come into work. He said that our entire database had been deleted and they needed my help to recover the missing data. I knew it was just a dumb coincidence, but Tommy saw it as proof that the app was real, that I was going to stab him. He rushed into his closet, packed up a suitcase of clothes, and told me that he'd stay at Spencer's until the app told him that it was safe to come back. I felt like screaming at him. How could he be so gullible? No technology had the power to predict the future. Couldn't argue with him, though, because, well, he was already gone. Besides, I had to deal with my work emergency. I went to my office, and I spent the next few hours redoing all the work that I had done for the last month. So frustrating, but I was able to finish as much as I could. My boss still didn't know what caused us to lose all that data, but he promised me it wouldn't happen again. When I got back home, I was exhausted and angry. Tommy still wasn't back yet. I was alone, and I didn't know what to do with myself. I tried watching TV, but I kept thinking about that stupid app. I knew it wasn't real, but I couldn't stop thinking about it. So, eventually, I pulled out my phone and I went to the App Store to see if I could download it. I remembered the app's name and I found it right away. It was available to download for free, so I did. As it was loading, I saw that it was released yesterday, didn't have any reviews yet, and the publisher was unlisted. And that's when I realized what had really happened. This app was a joke, after all. It was created by Spencer, Tommy's brother. Spencer was a computer genius with way too much time on his hands. He created this app to mess with his brother. I guess Black Mirror had inspired him. The app probably wasn't even connected to an AI engine. Spencer was probably typing the answers himself. Which means that he also sabotaged my work, using his computer skills to delete a bunch of files just so he could prove that the app could predict the future. I had wasted all day at work because of a prank. It was insane and way too complicated. I had to figure out how to get back at him. I got a message on my phone saying that the app failed to download. I guess it was just made for Tommy. I got in my car and I drove straight to Spencer's house. I parked across the street so that he wouldn't see me, and then I snuck around to the side of the building. I could see Spencer and Tommy through the window. They were sitting together, talking about me. Tommy still seemed freaked out, and Spencer was trying to calm him down. He could barely hide his smirk. Very quietly, I walked to the next window, the one outside Spencer's office. When I looked inside, I saw his computer still running. I pushed the window open and crawled inside. Thankfully, Spencer had stupidly kept his screen on. I didn't know a lot about coding, but I could tell that he was still connected to his fake app. As I thought, no AI was involved. It was basically just a fancy-looking chat service where a user would type in a time, and then Spencer could manually type in a reply. That was it. That was how he could predict the future. I got onto his computer and started typing. I assumed that the message would pop up on Tommy's phone. I wrote, "Your future has changed. Now you will be attacked by your brother. He's in the room with you right now. Do not tell him that you suspect anything." Then I sent the message. I could hear Tommy's phone ding from the other room. And then I waited. I expected to hear Tommy freak out and run out of the house. I didn't expect to hear all the screaming and banging sounds. I opened the door to look into the living room, and I saw Tommy standing over his brother's body. He had a broken lamp in his hands. He had used it to hit Spencer on the head. This had gone way too far. I ran into the room and screamed for Tommy to stop. "What are you doing here?" he asked. I didn't answer. I didn't know what to say. I just stared at Spencer's body, twitching on the ground. He was going to kill me," Tommy explained, tears leaking from his eyes. I told him to put the lamp down. I tried to explain about the app, but he wouldn't believe me. I told him to look on Spencer's computer and see for himself. His face completely blank, he dropped the lamp and walked into Spencer's office. He was there for a while, probably looking at the computer screen. That gave me some time to call an ambulance for Spencer. I went into the office to find Tommy, but he wasn't there. The window was still open, and it looked like he'd made a run for it. I went back to Spencer, who was barely conscious and bleeding out of his ears. Together, we waited for the ambulance to arrive. I went with Spencer to the hospital, where the police were waiting for me. I told them all about the app, about how it was a prank that went horribly wrong. I said that Spencer would corroborate my story once he got out of the emergency room. Unfortunately, he never did. He slipped into a coma and is still unconscious. It's been 3 days, and no one knows where Tommy went. I hope that Spencer wakes up. I hope that Tommy will reappear somewhere. But for now, I have no idea what to do with myself. I feel so guilty about how things turned out.